Robinhood Radio presents Stage Right or Not with Michelle Willems. Michelle is a longtime journalist and herself is a published playwright of several theatrical works. She's a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post, Daily Beast, and the Atlantic websites.
Well, theatrical ambition can come in all sizes, small, medium, and large. This past week, I saw two productions that are ambitious and being difficult to pull off. One, written in the 17th century, is playing at a small venue but using every inch of it. The other is in New York's most spectacular and flexible of places. Neither is for the shorter is better intermission-free crowd. The Red Bull Theater is always pushing the edge, presenting farce, tragedy, even inventive nonstop rhyme. The company's mission is to revitalize classics, somewhat like the Mint, but that one tends to choose less challenging, softer works. Red Bull's current production is The White Devil, settling in at the Lucille Lortel in the West Village. The company calls this a provocative reimagining of a disturbingly timely classic. I was not familiar with the play by John Webster, which debuted in London in 1612. Hardly timely, but a stellar and large cast dressed in contemporary clothing is fluently directed by Louisa Prosky, and occasionally they join or share dramatic sentiments with the audience. The play deals with duplicitous dukes, sibling rivalry, infidelity, and murder by many means. Webster apparently was known as a writer deliciously presenting gore in all flavors. The White Devil moves briskly. It can be a bit hard to follow who is doing what to whom, but you can appreciate the cleverness of Webster's words. Women are like cursed dogs. Because we are poor, shall we be vicious? And yes, even some of them resonate all these centuries later. For example, you have in 3 years ruined the noblest earldom. And this gentle penance may both end your crimes and in the example better these bad times. The White Devil is ambitious in what it asks of its audience, but by now Red Bull has earned its loyal fans and supporters. So now we move uptown to the Park Avenue Armory, which never fails to astound in how it reconfigures space. The current production, the Lehman Trap Trilogy, is potentially its most successful theater work. It was written by an Italian in 2004, originally as a radio play, and apparently ran for more than 5 hours. Well, now it's directed by the ever-inventive Sam Mendes, and it's been reduced to 3.5, 3:45, with two intermissions. Most amazingly, it has only three actors who play a multitude of characters. This play is, in fact, about ambition, as we follow three Jewish-German brothers, the Lehmans, making their way to this country, where one says, everything changes, including your name. The Lehmans' journey begins in Alabama, where they sell fabrics and are dependent on cotton-picking slavery. That obviously changes with the war between the North and the South. But the enterprising brothers forge on over the decades. Wives are introduced, heirs are born. Eventually, of course, the Lehmans land on Wall Street as a full-fledged bank, where, says one, we use money to make money. Their most earth-shaking challenge, not surprisingly, was the crash of 1929. And be prepared here for the sound of gunshots. Later, the Second World War turns out to be, as one brother says, good for business, but recovery will be even better. Judaism, found, lost, and sort of found again, remains a theme in the backdrop. What most matters here are the three actors, Simon Russell Beale, Adam Godley, and Ben Miles, who play all the family members and their wives and even their screaming infants. And then there is the dazzling set, a giant rotating glass box. Projections surround and light up the action, and we feel we are right there in the cotton fields of the South and the changing landscape of New York City. And yes, Miss Liberty is a powerful supporting player and reminder. Did I love the Lehman Trilogy? Well, first, it doesn't matter. Most everyone does, and the show is virtually sold out. I certainly appreciated it, but in the end, I think that it may really be a radio play at heart. The stage directions are narrated by the actors, which I always find rather annoying and unnecessary. There's a lot of telling rather than showing or doing both simultaneously. He plays with his beard. The brothers stare at each other. I looked out the window, and so on. Now, clearly, there is method and thought behind all this. Yes, it drains the show of true emotion, but perhaps that's a point. These were calculating men from start to finish. Resolve the marriage problem is how one writes about what most would consider a sentimental subject. Well, ultimately, I'm glad they chose to do the Lehman trilogy at the Armory, in fact, rather than on a Broadway stage, sort of admitting up front that it is an artistic epic, more than a traditional piece of theater. Now, finally, I'd like to say that among the most emotionally ambitious productions are the one-character pieces currently playing on various stages around the city, and so much for the old description, one-man show. These are all in the voices of women. Fleabag, written and performed by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, is selling out every performance at the Soho Playhouse. This one is described as raunchily resonant and somewhat self-obsessed, but then one-character shows are by definition self-obsessed. Then we have Maddie Corman, the actress and playwright who's Accidentally Brave, is playing a DR2 downtown that deals with her particular crisis, discovering that a husband had been into child pornography. Now, some love this show, others find it entitled and distancing, but few question the title. The same must be said of Suzanne Tufant's theatrical memoir called Whore, focusing on a difficult father. That one is at the Paradise Factory in the East Village. I recently saw a reading of A-Train, performed and written by Annie Torsiglieri. It deals with one mother's harrowing journey of raising an autistic son. And Heidi Schreck's What the Constitution Means to Me has just opened on Broadway to rave reviews. Considering the times we live in, well, perhaps it's not surprising that we are getting so many women on stage, standing there by themselves, telling their own stories. Well, as we know, Jill, we have a lot of stories to tell if people are willing to listen.
And as presumably as... Yeah, of course, this is a philosophical question. You can shoot me now. Sorry. Is every story worth telling?
That's a great no. Obviously not. But look at the number of memoirs, the hottest selling.
I understand.
You know,
I'm not. I mean, it's mildly. Again.
No, I agree. I agree, and I think that often with one-man shows as well. There was a recent one that was on Broadway, didn't last very long, and I can't remember, a very likable performer talking about, it was a Broadway show about becoming a father. I didn't see it, but most people said, you know, he didn't say anything. Why is his becoming a father such
special.
A different story than, you know? So no, maybe you say it in a different way. You do it with interesting, in an interesting style, or you come up, but I don't know. How many stories can we see about autism? Are they important? Of course. And everybody feels their story is the most important and heartbreaking. But you got to tell them well. I guess that's the bottom line.
Right. And as with museum shows, I go to this all the time, or gallery exhibitions or anything like that. The actual definition of the word curate, you know, it's I used to like to say to people, yeah, every artist has, even Picasso has bad days. They didn't make the works not Picasso, but they weren't as, they weren't masterpieces.
That's right.
Every single thing is not a masterpiece.
Yeah, that's right. I went to see the Warhol show exhibit last week, you know, which is a huge, huge success down at the Whitney. You know, I've seen a million Warhol shows, and I was trying to think, actually the most interesting one I'd seen was at the Norman Rockwell Museum, and it was called Rockwell Warhol. And it found amazing comparisons and even parallels between their work. Now, that was a new way of telling sort of old story, you know?
Right,
so,
no,
yeah, curating is a good word.
It's not just about getting a mass of paintings and borrowing them and slamming them up on the wall.
That's right.
And
that's right.
It's one of those things that looks if you are focused on the end use, like, oh, this is an exhibition, wonderful, and yeah. you don't know what goes into it. Now, obviously, if you are in that business, you do know what goes into it, just as if you are in the theater, you know what goes into actually mounting a play. But just generally, what is seeming, it's seeming like a lack of editorial wisdom or a lack of curating. And again, it doesn't take away from the fact that everyone, when I say everyone, you know, you feel you've got a story to tell, by all means.
Absolutely. But I say that all the time when I go to, pardon the expression, funerals. And one thing I enjoy about funerals is you learn people's stories. Even if you thought you know the person, you learn the backstory. And I always do say everybody has a story. It doesn't be, is it necessarily a play or a memoir? You know, Justin Bieber wrote a memoir when he was 15. Now, did he have a story at 15? He didn't have a life story. I'm sure he had a story in there.
He had an experience, and, you know, he was young and and that was the experience. But that doesn't alter the fact that if the guy doesn't have any more experiences when he's 30 or 45, or assuming yeah. that he, you know, he continues, assuming that he continues to live, right. it's that the story is going to end up being a chapter.
Well, that's right. And let's face it, most of our lives are probably chapters. We hope that they're good chapters, and we hope they're not the final chapters. But sometimes they are. I just did a review of a very good Audible about Philip Roth. Now, people say, what could be new about Philip Roth? He died a year ago, of course. But this was Jim Atlas, who was the writer and narrator. It was his own memoir about his relationship with Philip Roth. Well, that's different, you know, and then we got real insights into Philip Roth as a friend, as a mentor. So again, there are different ways there are people we are endlessly interested in. I didn't know I was interested in the Lehman Brothers, and I'm not so sure that I am, but through telling their stories, we kind of got the history of immigration and Judaism, you know, not fully and not completely, but it's about much more than three brothers who got off a boat.
Stage Right or Not with Michelle Willens, produced in the studios of Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com.